Okay, so let us continue with the seventh lecture now. Remember that so far we only studied the differentiable structure of a manifold. So far we did not have a concept of what the distance between two points on a manifold is, other than numerical distance of coordinates. So we don't have yet a coordinate system independent notion of how far away two points on a manifold are. At the end of the last lecture, therefore, I indicated which way this is going. We need to introduce the metric. The metric is an extra notion that we introduce to be able to determine the small distance between close by points. And from that, we can then integrate up and get the distance between any two points on a manifold. And once we know the distances on a manifold, we implicitly also capture its shape. So we start now with the metric tensor. Remember that in special relativity, in Minkowski space, if we choose inertia and Cartesian coordinates, then the distance between two events, or more precisely, the distance squared between two events, that's the invariant distance, which you remember can also be negative. So the invariant distance squared between two events is then given by the time distance squared with a minus sign and the spatial distance squared. This is compactly written using a metric tensor, the eta mu nu, given by coefficients eta mu nu, and contracting the indices in this way. I'm sure you're all very familiar with this. In our convention, the metric will be such that the time coordinate comes first with a minus sign and then the space coordinate. I hope I'm consistent about that throughout the course. However, even when we are working with Minkowski space in special relativity, we are free to choose other coordinates. We may choose, for example, polar coordinates in the xy plane or spherical coordinates in the xyz spatial volume. Or we might even choose an accelerated coordinate system that whirls about. Okay? Can do all of this. And if we do that, then the invariant distance between any two points is no longer going to be given in this fancy coordinate system simply by this expression, but instead, it will be something that starts out like that for small distances, but it will have correction terms because the whole thing will be messed up by nonlinear transformations of coordinates. So in particular, in a non-trivial coordinate system, the g mu nu, which replaces the eta mu nu, will no longer take the simple form of that matrix. Instead, it will be something really complicated. It will be a matrix that is position and time dependent. And yet, it's still just describing Minkowski space. If somebody gives you g mu nu of x and says, this describes Minkowski space, but it doesn't look like it, it's not like that. It's a matrix that has position and time dependent entries, then how can you check whether it really describes Minkowski space? Well, in principle, you can check by searching for a coordinate system, by searching for a change of coordinates, such that in this new coordinate system, this metric tensor matrix takes that form. If you succeed, then you have confirmed that this was indeed simply the metric of Minkowski space written in fancy coordinates. Now, historically, the transition from special relativity to general relativity happened by allowing g mu nu of x's, which in no coordinate system will look like eta mu nu. This is the approach that Einstein took. So he said, well, we know from special relativity how to handle g mu nu of x's that are not eta mu nu. It's just the change of coordinates after all. But he said, well, what if we use g mu nu of x's that in no coordinate system reduce to eta mu nu? That will describe something more than special relativity, that's for sure. What exactly does describe is not so clear a priori, but it will go beyond Minkowski space because there's no coordinate system in which this reduces to the Minkowski space metric like that. So therefore, such general G-mu of x will take us beyond special relativity. Then Einstein enforced the equivalence principle. He said that, well, locally, no matter how curved spacetime turns out to be, locally, spacetime ought to be flat. Locally, we should have the ability to choose a coordinate system such that special relativity holds in an approximation. That meant that the G mu nu were still allowed to be pretty arbitrary, so they don't have to reduce to the eta mu nu in any coordinate system. However, Einstein required that the G mu nu be such that for any given point that you may choose on the manifold, there exists a coordinate system such that at least at that point and its infinitesimal neighborhood, in that coordinate system, the G mu nu of x is that. So at the point exactly, it's this, and in the neighborhood, it's almost that, up to a small correction. This was to say that locally, at any point, you can choose what will turn out to be a free-falling coordinate system, that's Cartesian, such that you have special relativity holding there in a very good approximation. This is not the modern way to look at it. Let's see, we will get to that in a moment. What is mathematically really going on here? Remember that the metric tensor is a covariant tensor of rank 0,2. It's twofold covariant. The same was true for eta in special relativity. So now, if we choose basis vectors in the cotangent space, for example, theta mu of x, so for every point x of the manifold, we choose a basis in the cotangent vector space, and we call this basis theta mu. If we are lazy, we may just choose the basis that comes along with a coordinate system, right? So we choose a coordinate system, x mu, and then the differentials of the coordinate functions, the dx mu, form a basis of the cotangent space. But we don't have to choose that basis, right? So let's just say we choose a basis, theta mu, of each of the cotangent spaces. Then the metric tensor, which depends on position, is given by some coefficient matrix. Remember, this is not a tensor. This is a matrix of coefficient functions. So the tensor is given by this matrix of coefficient functions contracted with these basis vectors in the space of twofold covariant tensors. See, my collaborators are hard at work updating stuff on Dropbox. Okay. All right, so this is a basis vector in the tangent space. That's a basis vector in the tangent space. These are basis vectors in the space of covariant two tensors. And here we have a covariant two tensor. If we choose this thing symmetric, then we have a symmetric covariant two tensor. Okay. Remember that this thing needs to be what is called non-degenerate. We defined that at the end of the last lecture. It means that as a matrix, it's invertible. So now, if the G mu nu is this coefficient matrix is indeed invertible at every point, then it means that there exists a G inverse, which is a tensor of rank 2, 0, and whose coefficient matrix we write with upper indices. And the coefficient matrix now multiplies, of course, basis vectors in the tangent vector space, the tensor product of basis vectors in the tangent vector space, where the E, we choose to be the dual basis to the theta that we chose above. And the invertibility means that the G mu nu with upper indices exists and obey this property. It's the inverse matrix, literally, for the G with the lower indices. This allows us now to give a more modern view of the equivalence principle. Remember, we asked that for each point in the manifold, there exists a coordinate system such that when we choose these bases, that was implied in Einstein's historical derivation, such that when we choose these bases in the tangent and cotangent vector spaces, then the metric tensor, given as usually in this way, happens to have a coefficient matrix, which is eta mu nu at that point. Okay, so that's the historical way to write the equivalence principle. At every point of the manifold, for every point of the manifold, there should exist a coordinate system such that if we choose the basis that comes along with the coordinate system, then in that basis, the coefficient matrix of our metric tensor happens to be the eta mu nu. But you see, this is terribly inefficient because it says that for every point in the manifold, there exists a coordinate system. Well, we're talking about points in the manifold. Why would we care about an entire coordinate system? And in any case, how can coordinate systems have anything to do with anything in physics? That's just our choices of naming points. What we see here is that if the historical definition of the equivalence principle holds true, then what it really means is that for every point in the manifold, there exists a basis in the tangent vector space, sorry, in the cotangent vector space, such that the coefficient matrix of our metric tensor is this. Okay? Forget about coordinate systems. It simply means that for every point of the manifold, you can find a basis of the cotangent space such that this coefficient matrix, or more precisely, this coefficient matrix, because you know, you just choose the basis suitably, is of the form eta mu nu. Okay? So what the equivalence principle says is that the G mu nu has to be such, or the G, the symmetric two tensor, has to be such that for every point of the manifold, there is a basis of the tangent space such that the coefficient matrix is simply eta mu nu. So for suitable choice of bases at all points, the coefficient matrix is, in fact, eta mu nu everywhere at once. This has nothing to do with coordinate systems. It's independent of your choice of coordinate system, whichever one you choose. As long as you choose your basis suitably, the G mu nu of X matrix actually becomes eta mu nu, constant everywhere. And all the information, you may wonder, well, where's the information then, right? If the G becomes eta mu nu everywhere, how can the G encode the curvature of space-time, the non-triviality of distances in the manifold? Well, it will be encoded in the relationship between the basis of the theta mu nu that will diagonalize our G and the basis that comes with your coordinate system. So you choose a coordinate system, and then in that coordinate system, you can write down your local changes of basis from your dx mu's to those theta which diagonalize the G everywhere. We won't do that today, but I just want to outline where this is going. Okay. Okay, so the modern formulation of the equivalence principle is then that independently of any choice of coordinate system, there are choices of dual bases, theta mu of x, of the tangent, of the cotangent space and the tangent space, such that the coefficient matrix for that basis, namely if you feed into your covariant two tensor of the metric, remember it's a covariant two tensor, it is hungry for two tangent vectors. If you feed it two tangent vectors for that choice of basis, you get the eta mu nu matrix for all x of the manifold at once. Okay, so now we will not use yet the full power of that insight. We will still most of the time use the basis that comes along with the coordinate system. Just keep in the back of your mind that we don't have to do that, and it might have advantages. Okay, so once we have our metric, G mu nu, what else can we deduce from that? Well, since we can now calculate distances, we can also calculate volume, which is to say that the G mu nu will induce a volume form. Remember, volume form is an N form, a maximal form, an N form, which is positive, everywhere positive. Or at least it doesn't go through zero. You can also define all your volumes to be negative. But in any case, it's not supposed to go through zero. The G also provides something else which is very important. You see, the sequence of points that I'm going to list now will end at the bottom with wave equations, with dynamics, with the laws of nature for physical field. So on that way, the first step is that along with the metric comes the inverse metric, and they yield a duality of covariance and contravariance, the thing that you already know as raising and lowering indices. But what it means technically is that it provides a map from the tangent space to the cotangent space. That space is independent. Also, the metric gives us an operation, a famous operation that is called the Hodge-Star operation. What that does is it's a map which takes P forms into N minus P forms, where N is the dimension of the manifold. That will turn out to be a kind of duality, because if you apply it twice, you get from an N minus P form back to a P form in a way that you actually get back the original form, the original differential form, up to possibly a minus sign. And the importance of this star operation is that it gives us an inner product on the space of P forms, on differential P forms. An inner product, which means that you can take a differential P form and then take the inner product with another differential P form and you get a number out of it. It's an inner product that makes the space of P forms a Hilbert space. It makes, in fact, the entire space of differential forms, the entire Grassmann algebra, into a Hilbert space. And how does it do it? Why would the Hodge-Star be important for that? Well, let's say you want to feed here a p-form and there another p-form. In order to obtain a number, a coordinate system independent number, one possibility one might consider is multiply those two differential forms and integrate them over, right? The way we are used to from quantum mechanics. Take two wave functions, multiply them, integrate them over. You get an inner product between them. But here we have a problem because our manifold is n-dimensional, let's say. And if we take a P form, multiply with a wedge product, let's say, to keep it consistent, with another P form, well, then we get a 2P form. A 2P form cannot be integrated generally over an n-dimensional manifold. It can be integrated over a 2P-dimensional manifold. This is where the Hodge-Star comes in. Because what it means is that if you take a P form and another P form, and one of them gets the star applied to it, then you have a P form, a wedge, an N minus P form. In total, that's an N form. And remember, N forms can be integrated over N dimensional manifolds. So this is how we will get a Hilbert space of differential forms. And then once we have a Hilbert space, we can ask, what is the adjoint of an operator? We can either have it act on the right wave function, if you like, or we can have it to the left. We can have either the operator itself or its adjoint. And in particular, we will study the adjoint to our exterior derivative. Remember the co-boundary operator. We will study the adjoint of that, And the adjoint will be called the co-derivative. And just like the exterior derivative, the D, is of degree plus one, it raises the degree of a differential form. It takes a two form into a three form, a three form into four form. The co-derivative will be doing the opposite. It maps P forms into P minus one forms. And then we are almost ready for wave equation. Because then we can use the exterior derivation and the co-derivative, combine them in such a way to obtain the Laplace operator or the D'Alembert operator. And once we have that, we can then define wave equations, like the Klein-Gordon equation, but also electromagnetism and so on. The Laplace operator and the D'Alembert operator are second derivative operators, and so they will indeed be a combination of this and that. It's basically going to be the anti-commutator of D and del. It's D del plus del D. All right. Okay, so that was just a preview of what's coming up. The first point on our list was that given the notion of distance, which is to say given the metric, this induces for us a volume form. A volume form is a n-form that's positive. So if we integrate it over a chunk of space-time, we get some positive volume out of it. So how does the metric induce a volume form? Let's assume, as always, that our manifold M is oriented. And consider a positive chart. Remember, a chart is positive if its Jacobian determinant with respect to all charts of a given atlas is positive. Then we define the volume form induced by the metric as the N form given in this way, choosing the canonical basis that comes along with the coordinate system, and the square root of the determinant of the coefficient matrix of our metric G. So it's the absolute value of the determinant. I should really have two bars here, one set of bars to indicate the taking of the determinant, and another one to indicate that we take the absolute value of it. Well, and then we take the square root of it. Now, why would that be the correct thing to do? Why not take the seventh power of that? Or the 2.1st power or whatever, right? Why the square root of this? Well, let's prove that this is a well-defined volume form. First, we have to check that it's not zero for all points of the manifold. That is true because the coefficient matrix G is assumed to be non-degenerate. It has an inverse. Also, we have to check whether it's well-defined. And that means our definition, which was made in a coordinate system, right? We chose a coordinate system to write this down. But it's only well-defined. It's only a definition that's independent of coordinate system if we arrive at the same n-form if we define it in another coordinate system. So let's see. So if we choose another coordinate system, so we go from the coordinate system of the x's to a coordinate system of the x tildes, then the coefficient matrix in the new variables is given by the coefficient matrix in the old variables multiplied with those Jacobian matrices. If we view this as a matrix with two indices, that's a matrix with two indices, that's a matrix with two indices, and this is a matrix with two indices. Let's write this matrix on that side, and then we notice that the index structure is such that this matrix here is actually transposed before it's contracted with that matrix. not that the transposition would matter, but it's a detail. So this matrix is given by the transpose of that Jacobian matrix multiplied with that matrix multiplied with this matrix. If we now take the determinant of this equation here, then we obtain that the determinant of the new coefficient matrix is given by the determinant squared of the Jacobian matrix and the multiplied with the determinant of the original coefficient matrix. If we take the square root of this, we get rid of that power 2 here, but we get square roots over there. Now, as we change coordinates, not only will the square root of g, will the determinant of g change, as we just calculated, it changes by a certain factor, by Jacobian factor, but as we change coordinates, also this thing, of course, changes a bit. We cannot simply put tildes on there. No, it also picks up a factor. And what is that factor? Well, it's the determinant of the Jacobian of the change of basis. We calculated that earlier. So what we have is that as we change coordinates, the determinant of g changes in this way, and the square root of the determinant changes simply by a Jacobian determinant. The measure factor in the integral, or the n form, changes also by a Jacobian determinant, but it's the opposite of this one. It's the inverse of it. This is dx by dx tilde, and this is dx tilde by dx. So they just cancel. Therefore, as we go from our candidate volume form to the candidate volume form in a new coordinate system, we have two changes, one arising because of the change of measure, and one arising because this thing transforms. It's not a scalar after all. And so those things cancel each other, and they are exactly the same. So we've shown that this gives us a positive n form that is independent of the choice of coordinate system. Let us introduce some notation here. Let us define the so-called epsilon tensor. I'm sure you've seen that before. It is having n indices, and its entries are plus 1 if the indices take values that are an even permutation of 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. up to n. And the entry is minus 1 if the entries are an odd permutation of the numbers from 1 to n. And the entries are 0 when these are not simply all the numbers from 1 to n, but if something occurs multiple times, if some number occurs multiple times. In special relativity, remember that this epsilon tensor was a canonical tensor. It was independent of the Cartesian coordinate system that you may have chosen. It's independent, it's invariant under Lorentz transformations. In general relativity, that's not so. But we can use it to express our volume form. Remember, the volume form is given by the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the coefficient function of the metric times the canonical basis vector of n forms. And we can now also write this as the same prefactor here, same coefficient function. And then instead of the wedge product, we spell out what it is. We spell it out as the totally anti-symmetric tensor product that it is. It's a tensor product of all the basis vectors, and then anti-symmetrically added. Remember, repeated indices are always summed up. But that means that we can now also write our volume form in terms of a coefficient function multiplied with the tensor product of all possible basis vectors there. It's a bit of a wasteful way to write it, but it will be useful. And that coefficient function here, we call omega I1 to IN. This is the covariant thing That replaces the epsilon tensor up there. This omega, the volume form induced by the metric, is called the canonical volume form. It's also called the pseudo-Riemannian volume form, and it's also called the metric volume form. In the list that we had earlier, the list that eventually led to the definition of the wave equation, the next point was again, in the direction of defining Laplace and D'Alembert operators. Now, what's a D'Alembert operator? What's a Laplace operator? They are operators that are second derivatives from special relativity, at least. So we expect that to carry over to general relativity. But also, the Laplace operator and D'Alembert operator should be non-directional. You don't Laplace differentiate in a particular direction. It's just the Laplace operator. It's a scalar operator. It doesn't have any directionality to it. Neither does the D'Alembert operator. By the way, what is the difference between the Laplace and D'Alembert operator anyway? It's just the signature of the metric. If we're dealing with a Riemannian metric and a Riemannian manifold, then the operator will be called the Laplace operator. And if time is also involved, then we will call it a D'Alembert operator. This is the physicist terminology, by the way. Mathematicians will call everything the Laplace operator. But in physics, the D'Alembert operator and that symbol is used when we have time involved as well. Also, just to anticipate already where this is going, the Laplace operator should map, for example, Klein-Gordon fields into Klein-Gordon fields. In other words, it should map zero forms into zero forms, functions into functions. So we expect, what we want, that it will keep the degree of a differential form, should map P forms into P forms. So what strategy shall we adopt to define Laplacians and D'Alembert? Here's the strategy. First, we use G, the metric, as usual for the covariant-contravariant duality, to raise and lower indices, if you like. But of course, abstractly, it has nothing to do with indices per se. It's just a map from tangent into cotangent vector spaces and vice versa. We will be able to use that trick to define the Hodge star map that we talked about a little earlier, which will map R forms into N minus R forms. And then, as we already said, once we have that, we will obtain a Hilbert space of differential forms. And in that Hilbert space, we can look for the adjoint operator to our exterior derivative D. The adjoint will be the co-derivative denoted by del. It maps R into R minus 1 forms. And then the D'Alembert operator or the Laplace operator is simply the anti-commutator of D and del. And then the Klein-Gordon equation takes this form. So how again does this duality between covariant and contravariant tensors work? Let us view G as a map. We can view it as a covariant symmetric two tensor, but we can also view it as a map. We can view G as a map that feeds on tangent vectors and outputs cotangent vectors. You see how that works? You see, G is a two tensor. It's a covariant two tensor. It wants to feed on two tangent vectors and output a number. But we can also half satisfy its hunger by feeding it one tangent vector. And then what we are left with is one cotangent vector. So we can choose to interpret our metric G as a map which takes tangent vectors as inputs eats them up as its first argument, and then outputs a cotangent vector. So concretely, it feeds on a tangent vector, and then here we have the metric, remember? It chooses a basis in the cotangent space. This is the coefficient matrix of the metric in that basis for the space of covariant two tensors. And then we apply that metric on this tangent vector. Any tangent vector can be written as a linear combination of basis vectors in the tangent space. So we feed that tangent vector into this argument, into this cotangent vector here. We could also feed it into the first argument, but it doesn't make a difference because this will be symmetric. This is symmetric. Okay, so we feed that tangent vector into this cotangent vector, and we make use of the fact that the theta and the e are a dual basis to each other. So we are just left with the Kronecker delta and the coefficient functions xi I. So overall, we obtain g mu nu xi nu of x, and then the theta mu of x is left over from this. Here, those two guys annihilate each other. We're just left with that. This is just a coefficient function, and that's basis vectors in the cotangent space. So overall, what we have is that the metric G maps the coefficient functions xi mu into new coefficient functions now of a covariant tensor that we call omega nu of x, which is given by these coefficients here. The thing that you know under the name of raising and lowering indices. And similarly, the G inverse can be interpreted as a map that feeds on cotangent vectors and outputs a tangent vector in exactly the same way. So it simply raises the index, just like the ordinary G itself was lowering the indices. Remember, though, that really this was independent of choice of coordinate system. That's why I chose for the basis vectors the theta and the e, not the d by dxi and the dxi. All of this argument goes through if you choose arbitrary bases in your tangent and cotangent spaces, as long as they are dual bases to each other. So what we see is that the metric can be used to raise and lower indices no matter what basis you choose. You can stick with your coordinate system. Whenever you change bases, that's when you raise and lower the indices. Right, so the metric will raise and lower indices simply by contraction. I'm sure you've seen that many times before. Say, for example, the Tij, a Tijk is a three tensor. Sorry, if this is the coefficient function for a three tensor, which is twofold contravariant and once covariant, then the metric will turn this, for example, into a tensor that has coefficient functions Tijk, which indicate a tensor that is twofold covariant and once contravariant. And we obtain it by contracting the first index with the GI rho matrix. Cool. Okay, so now the next step was finally to define this Hochstar map, which maps P forms into N minus P forms. The point being that if you take two P forms and you want to calculate the inner product, you need to make them into an N form. You need to make the product into an N form, which you can then integrate over all of space. Okay, so how do we get a map from P forms to N minus P forms so that then the wedge product with another P form is an N form? Here's the trick. Let's say nu is a P form. It's a covariant tensor. It's a differential form, all right, but as such, it is also a covariant tensor. And we can use the metric to raise all its indices. Now you may wonder, where is this going? Because this takes us out of the differential forms. Right? Differential forms are always anti-symmetric, totally anti-symmetric covariant tensors. So now we take such a totally anti-symmetric covariant tensor, and we use the metric to raise all its indices so that it becomes a contravariant tensor. But the thing is, we can then put this contravariant tensor into the volume form. Feed it to the volume form. So for example, if this is a P form, the tensor is of degree P. The contravariant tensor that we obtained by raising the indices is of degree P. It's P-fold contravariant. If we feed that into the volume form, we get an N minus P differential form out of it. Because the volume form has only been waiting to be able to eat some contravariant indices, right? And we feed it P of them. So then it's left with N minus P totally antisymmetric component. Okay, so concretely, this is what's happening. Here's our differential P form. It is given by the wedge product of the bases here. Here we have the coefficient functions, and we have here 1 over P factorial, which is a definition for convenience. So that when we spell out what this totally antisymmetric wedge product is in terms of tensor product, then it's given by a tensor product with these coefficient functions. It's just that, you know, the total antisymmetry gives us P factorial combinations of the same thing. So we define the coefficient functions in such a way that it's the undecorated coefficient function in front of the tensor basis. Okay, so far we've simply expressed the differential form as the covariant tensor that it is. And you notice that it has all those lower indices in its coefficient function. We now use the metric, or more precisely the inverse of the metric, which is twofold contravariant, to raise all those indices. And this gives us a new tensor that we may call nu tilde. Nu tilde is obtained by raising all those indices. And now it's a contravariant tensor. So instead of those basis vectors, we have the dual basis vectors. And the coefficient matrix, sorry, this coefficient matrix is given in terms of that coefficient matrix by adding all those index raising metric tensors. Okay, so what we have arrived at is a contravariant, a p-fold contravariant tensor. So we started with a p-form. Now it's a p-fold contravariant tensor. And this p-fold contravariant tensor, we now feed into the volume form. The volume form really wants n contravariant tensors, but we feed it only p. So here's the volume form, omega, and we feed it the nu tilde. Concretely, it means that we take the coefficient matrix of the volume form and contract it with the coefficient matrix of our contravariant, p-fold contravariant tensor. And we are left with only n minus p indices. See, we feed, this has n open slots, and the first p of them will be occupied with eating up those contravariant components. So only the basis vectors from p plus 1 up until n are left over. But they're still totally antisymmetric, because these guys over there from p plus 1 to n are all antisymmetric, totally antisymmetric. This coefficient matrix that we now obtain is the coefficient matrix of an n minus p form, which we will call star nu. That's the Hodge star of nu. We started with a nu, which was a p form, and now we arrived at this thing, which is an n minus p form. It's what's left when you feed the volume form, the contravariant tensor that we obtained from the p form. So star nu is, by definition, the nu tilde fed into the volume form, and concretely, its coefficient matrix, when we write it out as the tensor product, is given by these entries over here. And we can also write this now with the wedge product again to make it more apparent that this is actually a differential form. But then we have to take into account that we are overcounting because of all the anti-symmetrization that goes on with the wedge product, n minus p factorial times. So we divide by that in order to have the match with this. And then we have a formula for the Hodge product of nu. Nu is a p form. Hodge of nu is an n minus p form. I mentioned earlier that the Hodge product is actually, or the Hodge star, not the Hodge product, the Hodge star operation, this thing, is actually a kind of duality. It's a duality because if you apply it twice, you get almost the same thing back. It's also called an involution. It's almost an involution. So let's say nu is a p-form. Then what happens if you apply it twice? Well, if nu is a p-form, Hodge star of it is n minus, is an n minus p-form. And then again, we apply that, we get a p-form again. And what is it? It turns out to be the same thing again, the nu, except for this possibility of a minus sign. It's minus 1 to the power of p times n minus p plus s, where s is the signature of spacetime, where s is the number of time-like coordinates that our spacetime has. In general, just one, but the math allows for several times. And then that could be a number other than 1. The number of time coordinates comes in because the metric is being used to raise and lower indices. This is how the Hodge star knows about the metric and therefore knows about the signature. The purpose of introducing the Hodge star was to make the space of differential forms into a Hilbert space, or at least into an inner product space. Turns out that it's not always a Hilbert space. So here's the definition. The Hodge star operator provides us with a scalar product or inner product for the space of differential forms, of differential form valued fields. Let's say alpha is a p-form and beta is also a p-form. Think of two quantum mechanical wave functions, for example. You want to calculate their inner product, the bra and the cat, if you like. But not necessarily scalar functions. They could be p-forms. They could be zero forms, all right, but they could also be p-forms, n-forms, whatever forms you like. In particular, it could be twice the same thing, for example, in order to calculate its norm. So let's say we want to calculate the inner product, the bracket of alpha and beta, both being p-forms. Then by definition, it is what you obtain when you take the p-form alpha, veg it with the n minus p-form star beta. Right? Beta is a p-form, but star beta is an n minus p-form. The whole thing, therefore, is going to be an n-form, right? Because it's p-form, veg, n minus p-form. The veg product leads to the addition of the degrees. So the whole thing is an n-form. And this n-form we can integrate over our n-dimensional manifold. So overall, that's a number. So that's a covariant thing to do, a covariant expression for the inner product of p-form. We can now also calculate the inner product of any differential form with any other differential form by linearly extending it. And by saying that the inner product of a p form with a q form, where q is not equal to p, is equal to 0. And then it's just simply by linear addition. It turns out that our, as I said, we'd like this to be a Hilbert space, but it turns out it's not always a Hilbert space. If the if the manifold is a Riemannian manifold, which is to say that the metric is positive definite, if there's no time-like coordinate, if there's no time-like direction, then this inner product is positive definite, and we obtain a Hilbert space, just like in ordinary quantum mechanics. If, however, a time variable is also there, then this is not positive definite. It's still an inner product, but it's not positive definite. So we need to be a little careful about using this. Either way, now that we have this inner product on the space of differential forms, on the Grassmann algebra, we can define what is called the adjoint for any operator, including our exterior derivative, our exterior derivation D, the co-boundary operator. And that adjoint operator we will call the co-derivative, del. Remember, the point is, why we need this is the following. We want the Laplace operator to be a second derivative operator, and it should map p-forms into p-forms, like functions into functions. For example, the Laplace operator on the Klein-Gordon field is again a Klein-Gordon field. So we need a second derivative operator, which is non-directional. So in principle, d is good. It's not directional. It's the first derivative. But what happens if we take d squared? Well, it's zero. So that's not going to do us any good. But it turns out that d combined with the del gives us all we need. Second derivative operator, non-directional, and covariant. So for any, I think I need to remind you of what the adjoint operator is. This is really a different kind of mathematics now. It's not differential geometry per se. This is functional analysis. Some of you may be completely familiar with this. Others, for the others of you, you may not worry too much about it. So here's the definition of what an adjoint operator is. Generally, for operators that act on a Hilbert space. Let's say an operator A acts on a Hilbert space. It maps a domain, the dA is standing for the domain of A, in a Hilbert space, into the Hilbert space. Then the adjoint of this operator is defined to have a certain action and a certain domain. You have to tell on what vectors it is allowed to act, and you have to tell how it is acting on those vectors. And the definition is, first of all, that the domain of the adjoint operator, A star, is given by all those vectors in the Hilbert space for which there, all those vectors V in the Hilbert space, for which there exists a W in the Hilbert space, such that for all z in the domain of our operator A, the action of A on z, inner producted with V, can also be accomplished by taking this W and taking its inner product with z. Then the W is by definition the image of a dagger on V. It might take a little getting used to, but it's just the precise formulation of what is meant by having an operator not necessarily act to the right, but having it act to the left. This is a little non-trivial because in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, one needs to worry about what the domain of allowed vector of vectors is on which a dagger is allowed to act. So the definition then is that the co-derivative is the adjoint operator. It's the thing that acts to the left. If you move it in the inner product space that we defined above with the hot star, if you move the D operator to the left, you get the co-derivative. Almost. Up to a minus sign. So the definition is that if you take the D operator and have it act to the left, you get up to a minus sign, the co-derivative. So it's the anti-adjoint. It's up to minus sine. It's the adjoint of D. So if you take a P form, no, let's just say an arbitrary differential form alpha and an arbitrary differential form beta. They don't have to be P forms or whatever. If you take an arbitrary differential form alpha and an arbitrary differential form beta, and you have the D act on beta, and you calculate the inner product according to the definition that we had above, this one. Okay. Remember, that can be extended by linearity to arbitrary P forms here, linear combinations of arbitrary P forms here, linear combinations of arbitrary forms of arbitrary degree over there. Then it's the same by definition. The codifferential is defined such that this is the same as the del is defined so that you get the same number if instead of having the D act to the right, you have the del act to the left on the alpha. So that's the abstract definition. What are its properties? But the properties are that, first of all, it maps P forms into P minus 1 forms, just because the D, that's the opposite. It maps the P forms into P plus 1 forms. But if you act on the other differential form, you have to do the opposite. And you can show that the codifferential is mapping differential P forms into star D star up to a minus sign. You can derive that from the definition. You can derive that from the definition of what is D and spelling out what that inner product really is. It's the integral over alpha and star beta. Right? So you have integral over alpha and then D of star beta. I mean, alpha veg D star beta. And if you want to put that over to the other side, I leave it to you as a little exercise at home. You see that it does just that. Properties are that the adjoint of our exterior derivative, derivative, del squared, is equal to 0. Just like the d squared is 0, the del squared is also 0. And one can show that in coordinates, it takes this form. If you apply the coderivative on a differential form and then raise its indices using the metric, then you have 1 over the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric. And then this bracket here, where you have, again, this metric factor, sorry, there should be bars over there. And then the differential form, again, with raised indices. And then you take the derivative, the partial derivative in the k direction. And if you lowered the indices, you would have many more things to worry about, because then you have lots of G matrices here and lots of G matrices over there and in there as well. So this is a simpler way to write it. So the message overall is this is very tedious stuff. So you want to do it abstractly whenever possible, because you don't want to get entangled in all those indices here. Another nice thing that the coderivative is inheriting from the exterior derivative, from D, is that is the fact that on contractible manifolds, the d squared is equal to 0, remember? Not the d squared is equal to 0. On contractible manifolds, every closed differential form is also exact. So if d omega is equal to 0, then the omega is the d of something else. It's integrable, right? Remember that? This was the basis of cohomology theories and so on. Now, it turns out that similarly, when M is a contractible manifold, or in every contractible part of a manifold, it is true that when the coderivative of a differential form is 0, then the nu is also the coderivative of something else. This is very similar to what is true for the exterior derivative. For the exterior derivative, we have that if d nu is equal to 0, then, at least locally, the nu is the d of some other differential form. And here we see that if the del of a differential form is 0, then at least locally, it is the del of some other function. And again, it's just two or three lines to show that this is so from the analogous property of the d. Also, please think about the question whether the d, the del, the coderivative, whether or not that is a derivation. After all, I did not introduce it as a derivation. Is it one? Think about it. Okay, so now that we have d and del, the coderivative and the exterior derivative, we can already write down the Maxwell equations on the manifold. So I hope that this gets you in more familiar territory now. Let us denote the electric field by components E1 to E3. Remember that the electric field is not a vector field. After all, it has only three components, E1, E2, E3. How can that be a vector in a four-dimensional spacetime? It's not. And also, the magnetic field doesn't have vector components. It's three components, B1, B2, B3, but spacetime is four-dimensional. How could the magnetic field be a vector field? It's not. Instead, the electric field and the magnetic field are actually components of a two-form, the field strength tensor. The field strength tensor is a two-form, and the coefficient matrix function, f mu nu, takes this form. It's totally anti-symmetric, so therefore, on the diagonal, it's clearly zero. And on the off-diagonal, it has, in the time-space components, the electric field, and in the space-space components, the magnetic field arranged in this way. So we notice that the field strength is a two-form. How about electric currents? It turns out that currents are naturally a three-form. We can write down a current four vector, j mu, and then contract with the totally anti-symmetric tensor epsilon to obtain this three form. See, this is a four form. It feeds, in principle, on four up to four contravariant vectors. We feed it only one contravariant vector, so we are left with three covariant, totally anti-symmetric indices, and we obtain a three form. This is special relativity. In general relativity, we would have a g, a square root of g in there. I'm just reformulating electromagnetism in the tensorial way now. But you can put a square root of g in there, and then it becomes general relativistic. So now we can already write down what the Maxwell equations are, namely the so-called homogeneous Maxwell equations are simply the statement that the exterior derivative of this two form is equal to zero. And the inhomogeneous Maxwell equation is that the co-derivative of our field strength tensor, of our field strength two form, is equal to the Hodge star of J. See, this is a two form. When we apply the coderivative to it, it becomes a one form. Right? Because the coderivative is lowering the degree of a differential form, whereas the D is raising it. So this is a one form on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, the J is a three form. When we apply the star to it, the hot star to it, it becomes a 4 minus 3 form, a 1 form. So we have the current 1 form over here. This is a cotangent vector field, which is just the lower ring of this thing, this with a lower index here. Must admit that the Maxwell equations look pretty simple in this way. Of course, when you spell them out, they become complicated, but differential geometrically, they are pretty simple. Some remarks are perhaps of interest here. The field strength tensor, the field strength two form, is assumed to be an exact two form here in electromagnetism, which is to say that we assume that F is the D of some other one form, A. And that one form you may know as the four potential, the electromagnetic four potential. This assumption alone guarantees the existence of the homogeneous Maxwell equation, because if F is indeed the D of A, well, then it's clear that dF is equal to 0, because it's simply d squared of A. See, so dF is equal to d squared of A then, which is equal to 0. And this is what is called a structure equation, because there was no physical input to it, except for the very basic assumption that F is an exact form. Well, let's put it this way. If you start with the Maxwell equations like that, then we know that locally, since dF is equal to 0, the F, at least locally, has to be the D of some other one form. We had a theorem on that. So either way, the fact that d squared of A is equal to 0, which is the statement that dF is equal to 0, which is the homogeneous Maxwell equations, is really nothing dynamical anymore. Once we see that electromagnetism has to be covariant, has to fit into the framework of differential geometry, then the homogeneous Maxwell equations pop out as automatic. They're called structure equations, because the structure of the mathematics requires them automatically. We couldn't get away without it. It turns out that general relativity also has structure equations. It has equations that must hold no matter what. Einstein had no choice in this matter because the mathematics was already predetermining that. And those structure equations in the case of general relativity will be called the Bianchi identities. Just keep an eye out on them. They will pop up at some point. By the way, the so-called gauge principle, for those of you who have encountered that before, the so-called gauge principle of electrodynamics is, in this new language, simply the observation that for every zero form, omega, the four-vector potential, A, and the four-vector potential, A tilde, which differs from it by the addition of a d omega, describe the same physics. Remember, the field strength tensor is given by dA, right? Now, whether you take d of A or you take the d of A tilde makes no difference. The field strength tensor is the same, because the d of A tilde is d of A plus the d squared of omega goes away. So the gauge principle of electromagnetism simply expresses the fact that if you add to the one form that describes the vector potential some exact one form, d omega, then it doesn't change the physics. Uh, That is to say, it doesn't change the classical physics. It turns out that the so-called Aharonov-Bohm effect, some of you may have heard of that, makes it possible to observe something about the A itself. Not just the F, but something about the A itself too. And if the space in which the experiment is taking place is not contractible, then it's not the case that the F is the D of just one A automatically. For example, if you take a solenoid, then where the current is actually flowing in the solenoid, this is not a place where your free space Maxwell equations would hold. And mathematically, it means that in this case, the space is not contractible. The F is not simply the D of 1A. And as far as physical experiments are concerned, you can have the electrons traveling one way around the solenoid or another way around the solenoid, will pick up interference patterns, relative phases that lead to constructive and destructive interference, which picks up the overall topology of the space. This, by the way, is an important effect that one tries to exploit in quantum computing, because those phases are independent of exactly how one goes, how an electron, let's say, moves to the right of a solenoid, or how exactly it moves to the left of a solenoid. The interference only matters on whether it goes right or left. So therefore, perturbations of the path make very little difference in the phase that you get at the other end. And that means that you have an effect which is robust against small perturbations, the kind of thing that we want for quantum computing. We are now ready to define the Laplacian and the D'Alembertians for our manifolds. The definition right here. The Laplacian is given by the anti-commutator of the co-derivative and the exterior derivative. It's del d plus d del. Clearly, this is mapping p-forms into p-form, because let's say we have a p-form over here. The del will turn it into a p minus 1 form. The d will turn it back into a p form. And here the other way around. So overall, it's mapping p forms into p forms. It's a second derivative, all right. And it's not directional either. In fact, it's a scalar operator. Now, if the signature S is 1, so if our manifold has one time direction, then this Laplacian is also called the D'Alembertian, mostly by physicists. Mathematicians would always call it the Laplacian. I should caution that some authors will put an overall minus sign in front of this, and some will not. And some will put a minus sign in the definition of the Hodge-Star operation so that they don't have to write it here. So this is an endless source of confusion, because in the literature, there is no agreement on that. Now, how does our Laplace operator act on functions? It actually acts on all p-forms. But to keep things simple, let's first look at how it acts on functions, on zero form. So the Laplace operator, or D'Alembert operator, acts on a function f by doing the following. You take your f, you take the partial derivative in the mu direction, contract with the inverse of the metric, multiply with this factor, and then the whole thing needs to be partially differentiated with respect to nu. The indices nu and mu get contracted, and then you divide by that. We will later see why that is so. But you can easily check that if you restrict attention to the case of Minkowski space with inertial Cartesian coordinates, then you do indeed get back the Laplacian that you're used to. Because the metric, I mean, these factors will just be one, and this will be just the eta mu nu, and this will be just second derivative. So therefore, you obtain that the Laplacian is this. I already gave away what the solution to the exercise is. Okay. All right. So what is the what are the properties of the D'Alembertian in that Hilbert space of differential forms then? Okay, so the D'Alembertian maps R forms into R forms. It maps nu into del d plus d del nu. And it obeys that if I have it act to the right, or whether I have it act to the right or have it act to the left, same thing. You can easily check that because d and del and d are adjoints of each other. So if, for example, here you have a del d and you want to move that over there, it becomes a d del and vice versa. So it is formally self-adjoint. If the inner product space is actually Hilbert space, so for the case of Riemannian manifolds, this is strictly Hilbert space, and that is strictly the definition of a self-adjoint operator. If the manifold has a boundary, you may have to choose boundary conditions in order to make the D'Alembertian self-adjoint. All right. I leave it to you to check a few properties of the D'Alembert operator, namely it commutes with the Hodge operator, which means that the spectrum of a p-form of p-forms, sorry, the spectrum of the D'Alembert operator on p-forms, we can diagonalize it. Think of it as being diagonalized. When we take the D'Alembert operator and we find its eigen p-form, well, we expect that the spectrum is closely related to the spectrum that it has on eigen n minus p forms, because it commutes with the Hodge operator, the Hodge star operator, which maps p forms into n p forms, right? Similarly, the D'Alembert operator commutes with the exterior derivative. The exterior derivative maps p forms into p plus 1 forms. Again, we expect that the spectrum of the D'Alembertian on p forms is somehow related, therefore, to the spectrum of the D'Alembertian on p plus 1 forms. And similarly over here, there must be a relation between the spectra of the D'Alembertian on p forms and the D'Alembertian on p minus 1 forms. This will play a role eventually when we will talk about spectral geometry. Remember, the question was, can you hear the shape of an object from the sound that it makes? And you will see that there are different kinds of sound. There is scalar sound coming from scalar propagating waves on the object, but there may also be vector waves or p-form waves on the object. And the spectrum that the object might have with respect to p-form waves propagating on it, those spectra are related to each other from p-forms to p plus 1 forms to n minus p-forms because of those relationships, as we will see later on. Okay, further consequences of the self-adjointness of the D'Alembertian. Well, the operators, the D'Alembertian can be diagonalized, and we will find that the on Riemannian manifolds, the spectrum of the D'Alembertian or Laplacian is always positive. According to some authors' definitions, there's a minus sign, and then it's always negative. For Riemannian manifolds of a finite volume, the spectrum of the D'Alembertian is always discrete, which is to say that, coming back to spectral geometry, can you hear the shape of objects? Well, this is the statement that as long as the object is of finite size, its spectrum is not continuous. Its spectrum has discrete frequencies. It's the intuition for it. And not only the spectrum for zero forms, but the spectrum for all p forms. And so therefore, the spectrum of the D'Alembertian is carrying a lot of information about the manifold, and we will, but with some constraints, because there's some redundancy in this, and we will get to that more, in more detail later on. It's spectral geometry. And finally, the Klein-Gordon action. So here's the Klein-Gordon field. The action for the Klein-Gordon field is by definition this. This is our volume form. Here we have the metric coefficient matrix, and here we have, which is just functions, a zero form. Here we have partial derivatives of the field, also zero forms. Overall, that's the action, the number. And this combination is arrived at in this way. You take the metric, which is when you take the inverse of the metric, this is a contravariant two tensor. And then these derivatives of the field are covariant, are differentials. They are covariant vectors, two of them. We feed them into that twofold contravariant tensor, that is the inverse metric, and we get this coefficient matrix. When we spell that out, we obtain the inverse of the coefficient matrix, the partial derivatives of the Klein-Gordon field, and our volume form had this, square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric. Now we integrate by parts. We take one of those derivatives and we integrate by parts. I should say why we do all of that. Remember, I claimed that the D'Alembert operator on a scalar function f has this complicated form. Where does it come from? Now we see where. This is the Klein-Gordon action. It couldn't be any simpler than that. Here is the Klein-Gordon action spelled out explicitly. Now I do an integration by parts, and this is what produces the complicated formula from above. Because if I now integrate by parts, the partial derivative, instead of acting on this phi, the phi will be lonely down there, not differentiated in any way. If I take that derivative on phi and I integrate by part, the derivative will act on everything else but the phi. It will differentiate this times that, okay? That's what it does. It differentiates this and that and this, all of this, okay? The integration by parts means it differentiates all of the rest, and it acquires a minus sign too, that's over here. And there would be just a number one over here, but we want the volume form again. So I write down that factor to get the volume form, and then divide again by it. And this whole business over here, we now call the D'Alembertian phi. That's where the formula comes from for the D'Alembertian. This is what it has to be. I mean, we derived it earlier from the abstract definition of D'Alembertian, but we see that it can only be this definition here, because it's got to be a scalar second derivative operator on scalar functions. Okay, so the action therefore takes this form. And we now finally obtain the Klein-Gordon wave equation. Remember, the Euler-Lagrange equations take this form for fields. In our case, the Lagrange density is given by that. And we apply the Euler-Lagrange equations on that Lagrange density, and we obtain the Klein-Gordon equation here. This is the case without a mass. Of course, we could add a mass term, and it would be D'Alembertian plus n squared phi equal to 0. By the way, which physical fields are described by Klein-Gordon fields? As far as we know, there are three types. There are meson fields. And I will end this lecture with this little survey here. There are meson fields. These are quark, anti-quarks systems, so-called pions. They transmit the nuclear force between protons and neutrons and among protons and among neutrons. Then there's the Higgs field. The Nobel Prize was awarded a few days ago for Higgs, Englert, and Robert Braut, who was a regular visitor here, but he unfortunately passed away 2 years ago. Otherwise, he would have been the third who would have been awarded the Nobel Prize. He was co-author with Englert on that prize-winning paper. And then there's the inflaton field, which is also a scalar field. These are the only three scalars that we know of in nature, and the meson fields are not even fundamental. All right. This is it for this lecture. Again, sorry that I went a few minutes over time.